freaking auto!
This is Brock and Salk.
Brock Huard is my hero.
What Brock Huard says? No, he's not a friend.
Subscribe to receive every episode at Apple Podcasts or on Google Podcasts.
Ah, we stink.
Now here are your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Salk.
No way!
Well, here we go with another Brock and Salk podcast. Hi, Brock.
Hello, Michael.
Howdy with us today.
Kyle will join us shortly.
Good.
Maybe.
Maybe. We'll see.
He's down at the Ghost Kitchen.
He is.
Uh-huh.
Is that where he spends his time these days?
Well, yeah, the Mariners in a little bit of a funk, so he's trying to do all he can to get it right. And we're not going to start with the Mariners, but yeah, he has turned to, I think, the Ghost Kitchen for preparation to kind of help ease the mind.
Where do you turn in moments like this, Howdy?
Bathtub. Deep thoughts. Bathtub.
I turn to rage cleaning, as I always
have. Rage cleaning. Now, what does
rage
that mean?
Rage cleaning. It means I pick a project and I just go in on it hard. Whatever scrubbing needs to be done, mm-hmm. I scrub. Mm-hmm. Whatever washing needs to be done, I wash. Man, I am rage cleaning like a monster trying to watch the Mariners hit a baseball.
You know, it's funny. I get the rage cleaning thing also. For me, it's usually either dishes or laundry. Mm. Like, oh, this is, and I would also say it's generally less with like baseball and more with like or domestic arguments. Mm. I would call them, right? When you get a little domestic argument and you're just like, well, I'm going to go clean. You just kind of like walk away. And like, I don't know. There's something, not only does it like take your mind off of it, like you were saying, Howdy, but it also sort of has the additional benefit of like, can't criticize me. I'm doing something to help the house.
Yep.
I don't know what you're talking about. I'm at least doing the dishes. I'm doing the laundry.
What
are you doing?
Howdy putting on like the old school gloves, like the
oh, like the latex?
Yes.
The elbow length latex.
Snapping them to make sure they're really on.
Yes.
That's it, Steven Souza. I am putting on the latex.
I will hit this grime more than Souza will hit any ball.
But I know we're going to talk about the Mariners later. And honestly, by the time we have this conversation, people listen to it, Steven Souza might not be on the major league roster anymore. But that's about as bad a night as a human being can have playing a baseball game.
That was a rough one.
To ground into a double play in that moment, followed by turning a pop-up into a triple. That's terrible.
Yeah. For a team that has no margin. That's right. Like the one scoring opportunity in like two games versus the Blue Jays. Like the one of the best. Well, that's not true. The night before they had some bases loaded, one out, Toro, you know, the opportunity, and they get nothing. But yeah, that was it's been a rough.
Let's be done with this.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. We'll move it along. Yep. Sorry about that.
We'll talk about them later.
It's fresh in my mind. I'm having difficulty getting over
it. I don't want to talk about that.
I don't want to see Howdy have to take out the Windex and start cleaning the computers here in the studio.
I'm going to take the keys off the keyboard again and bleach every one of them.
Got to go grab Stelton's disinfectant while we get going.
So
come
back
in with the spray gloves.
This would be a good question for Bob. Like, Bob's already cleaning. Like, what does he do in that rage spot? Like, if he can't rage clean, I wonder what Stelton does. Have to ask him about
jiu-jitsu.
The good thing is Bob probably never gets mad about the team, so that's, it's probably not a thing. You don't really need to worry about it. He's so calm, cool,
especially
and
now that he's hosting his podcast. He's become just a total pro.
Yeah, I don't.
It's almost sounds like NPR.
Yeah,
in his podcast voice. He's just so calm.
I'm sure. Yeah,
reassuring.
Never gets mad while watching. I had the chance, Brock, to talk to Clint Hurt this morning. He was awesome. And not a surprise, right? I mean, listen to his press conference, listen to other interviews. Like, this dude's inspiring. He's on it. He really, and I was saying it right afterwards, when he first got hired, I think there was some fear that he would, because
he'd
already
to Pete.
Well, yeah, that because he'd already been here, like, hey, you were here. Why didn't you make changes before? You're just part of the problem.
Yep.
And then when you listen to him, you're like, oh. He wants to do things totally differently. He's a 3-4 guy, not a 4-3 guy. He wants to totally change the way they play in the secondary. He's got a completely different philosophy from Pete.
Yes. Yes. But you do wonder, and not wonder, you know, it's being a good soldier. It's being a good teammate. It's being a good defensive line coach, Mike. D-line coaches, O-line coaches, not always, but pretty consistently are the rule followers. Like O-line coaches especially. Like you have rules. Like these are rules. When we do two jet, you slide and you step this way. And in life, in their world, is about rules, right? You have to. Otherwise, man, you have utter chaos. You have to have defined rules versus this blitz and this protection. And honestly, most O-line coaches in my lifetime, both as a player and now covering them, they all live in that same world, man. They are tacticians. They need a setup. They need rules to follow, and everybody's got to be orderly in that way. D-line coaches, maybe not quite as much, but they're combating that group. They're going after that group. Those guys have to, on their stunts and on their movements, there's not a ton of them, right? They've got the smallest playbook of any of them, mm-hmm. right? Pretty simple sometimes. See ball, go hit ball. And you know what? Here's this stunt, or here's that stunt, or here's a few things. But by and large, that's a pretty close position group. Again, through my life experiences, those D linemen, you can think about Ben and Averill and the friendships through the years of those guys, and D lines, the Bears, the Ravens, the Buccaneers with Sapp and Simeon Rag. That's a pretty, you know, pretty close group. So I guess as I say it out loud, it doesn't shock me that he got in line, that he was not going to be the one to throw Ken Norton under the bus. He was not going to be the one to create chaos with Pete Carroll, but he's certainly going to be an influence, and has to be, Mike, an influence of change on that side of the ball. Mm-hmm. If there's one thing that I've clamored for over the last 3 or 4 years more than anything else with you, what is it? What is it defensively?
More aggressiveness.
Yes. Don't sit there and let Matt Schaub, with his 40-year-old decrepit body, throw for 455 yards on you, for crying out loud.
Is that an actual number?
What?
Did he really throw for 455?
Howdy, can you look that up while you're cleaning the keyboard, please?
I mean, you said it was such great...
I think it was pretty close to
it
that.
It might be, yeah.
Howdy, what year was that? That was 2020,
it's fine.
Right?
I was just curious if you can look it up. Howdy's, something you had already looked up.
No, I'm pretty sure it was over 400 yards, and I think 455 or something like that resonated with me. Or Davis Mills starts 15 for 16, or any of these guys over the last few years, Mike, where you just... Man, you let them dictate. Why are you letting them dictate all the time what they want to do? And why can't you assert yourself? And you are no longer the team that has to deal with us.
You know, it's funny because I asked him about that specifically. I asked him what his philosophy was on, you know, who dictates to whom. And he said, look, the defense is a reactionary game. Like, you're always reacting to the offense. That's the way it goes. But he hoped that they would find ways to also force the offense to react to them.
You are reacting because whatever personnel they put on the field, right? That's the first thing that happens in any play. First thing on the sidelines. It's been super fun, honestly, over the 5 weeks of being on the field, kind of embedded with these teams as I have been in the USFL. And the very first thing, the very first action in any football play is the offense puts their personnel on the field. You'll hear it from the sidelines, 11, 10, 12, 22, bigs, whatever their personnel group that goes on the field. And that is the first domino that then the defense has to react to, because then they've got to put their personnel on the field, right? Unless it's the Super Bowl and, you know, Belichick's going to put goal line out there. But most of the 99.9% of the time, the defense does, to Clint Hurt's point. That's why he answered it that way. Mike, we've got to react. You know, if they put 11 personnel, three wides on the field, we've got to react with the plan. That it doesn't mean every single time that, you know, we have the same personnel against their personnel, but we've got our plan that week that's going to react to their personnel. It's going to react to their formation. It's going to react, you know, to their motion. So in that sense, it is very reactionary, but that's where it stops. Once that ball is snapped, then you've got an opportunity, in my mind, many times defensively, to dictate. And I certainly hope that Clint and this crew and the assembled staff around him are going to do, and I believe they will, do much more of that than they have done, certainly under Ken Norton's leadership.
Well, they're going to have to, right? And he talked about it right off the bat. He used the word aggressiveness. And I think when most people heard that term, I think the expectation was that he was talking about
blitzing
and getting after the quarterback and all of that. And not to say that that's not important. Obviously, it is. But I don't think that's exactly what he was referring to.
No, it's not being just blitz happy. He's not going to turn into Buddy Ryan. He's not going to turn into a group that just, you know, blitzes to blitz Rex Ryan.
And
that's not his background.
Him, right?
No.
I mean, at the end of the day, Pete, don't get beat deep.
Yes, he does not come out of the Rex Ryan tree, right? He does not come out of that. He comes out of of a little different tree, and he comes out of a tree that's morphed, and he's coming into a tree now, Mike, that's going to graft in some pretty cool components to it. You know, with Sean Desai and Carl Joseph, you've really, I think, not Carl Joseph, Carl Scott. You really, I think, in some ways, got to look at that trinity of those three as a total package, because I think Pete did. I think this organization did when they hired Clint. It was, man, we want your leadership. We want your background. We want your charisma. We want your character. We want your football. But we want that paired with a few other components here to do some very, very different things. Mm. And I know that he went into some detail with you on that today. How are you following, by the way?
How was I following it?
Yeah, how are you following it? These are the life moments
for
me.
I had to jump in a couple times and ask him about a few things, mostly because I was worried about the poor audience. I mean, I make sure everybody else understood. Uh-huh. He talked. Do you know what overhangs are?
Uh huh.
Oh,
on
you
line
do?
Of scrimmage.
Yep. How come you've never told me about overhangs?
See, this is where I'm a little. I don't know if I should have asked the question.
What?
Well, I mean, this is where.
Why didn't you ever tell me about overhangs?
I bet this is the point, and this is the time where it's like, man, father son relationship. Have I taught Titus enough about right? Birds and the bees, or you
probably
know,
not knowing you.
No, I have.
I'm going to go ahead and doubt that.
So now
you.
Here's my chance. You know, my 13 year buddy, my coworker for all these years. Have I taught Mike Salk enough about the birds and the no. Have I taught Mike Salk enough about the X's and the O's?
Yeah,
not just the Jimmies and the Joes, right? Because you and I, Jimmies and Joes, drafting wise, boom,
right.
Home run.
We'd be great.
We're on the same page.
Yes.
But if I taught Salk enough about the X's and O's?
Well, you did not teach me about overhangs. I had to ask about that one. What do you mean by overhangs?
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. Anything else go over you, or were you following pretty well?
I think I was
6'4", 4'6", 3". I mean, were we following pretty well?
I think I was doing okay.
Okay, good.
You know, he's going to have to not only – what the biggest thing I got from him, and I asked him to go into some great detail, is that not only would he be making changes to the front seven and the differences between the 3-4 and the 4-3, but that specifically he was going to be changing the style they play in the secondary in their zone defense.
Correct.
And that while they may still play a lot of cover two and cover three and some of the things that made the Seahawks famous, they'll be doing it with a very different style than they were before.
Yeah, I think, quite honestly, that is where fans, I mean, they will notice that, you know, the D linemen are not necessarily dropping into coverage a ton, which I don't think he was a huge fan of. They'll still have that. They'll still have drop eight. Maybe, one of those athletic D linemen can drop into his own. You know, they'll still obviously have that in the playbook. But I think most fans, even the casual to certainly the hardcore fans, are going to notice the secondary play right away. But even the casual fans are going to say, wow, that just looks a little different to me. Instead of just doing what they have done for many of these years with a kick step and stay over the top and drop into cover three and spot drop, okay, where you just
that was the phrase he used, spot drop.
Yeah, where you're just going to spot drop, like you literally here we go. Here's the whiteboard, and I need you to drop to this spot, and you need to get to this spot on the field. And
Harvey, have you ever heard Brock say spot drop in all of our time together?
I have. Maybe that's just my dad because we talk about spot dropping all the time when we're watching games together.
I
was confused about that, by the way. Didn't he say in your interview with him that the Seahawks have not been a spot drop team, that they've been a mirror match team?
He said that was the same. He said they've been a spot drop team.
Okay,
they've been
good, because they look like a spot drop team.
He said they have been, and that they're going to be going more towards being a team that matches up.
Yep. By the way, Howdy, you're too busy cleaning, rage cleaning.
You and Matt your dad Shaw. Talk about spot drops?
No, yeah, they do.
Of course we do.
That is an absolute lie.
We absolutely do. My dad was a high school football coach. We watch all sorts of different things in different ways when we watch games.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I'll allow it because I like your dad. I don't entirely believe you.
That is what they have been. Cam Chancellor's going to come down into the hook, you know, curl flat or the hook zone, and these guys are going to drop. And how many times have you seen these Seahawk linebackers through the last few years? KJ, him, Bobby, and just they're just dropping to these spots, and they're allowing all of this space and separation. So Matt Schaub on October 27th of 2019, Howdy didn't look this up because he's busy cleaning.
467
right
yards.
There you go.
460 yards passing.
You undersold it.
460
I did. I said
yards
455.
Passing.
I was off by five or more. 39 of 52. 39 of 52.
So
for 460 yards.
Yeah. It sounds ridiculous. When you hear that, I mean, generally, Pete Carroll's not a stupid guy, right? And this defense worked really, really well for a long time. So what is the advantage of the spot drop versus... Because there's got to be a reason they did it for so long.
Well, when you could rush four and be effective and harass the quarterback and tip the ball and have tips and takeaways, as they did with 39 of them in their Super Bowl year when they were a spot drop team with two very physical, very smart corners. Well, one of them, the other one's in prison for life right now, but the other one's super, super smart and could read and route and recognize. And Pete would tell you this, and this was, you know, when I went to the Indianapolis Colts, Mike, from the Seattle Seahawks. I remember being overwhelmed in many ways with our offense, but I remember being so underwhelmed by the defense and dropping back and going, gosh, there's a completion and there's a completion and there's a completion. And Oprah, everybody gets a completion. Like, this is so fun. And my numbers in the offseason were like super high. My completion percentage was super high because it was all this Tampa 2, cover 2. And guess what you do in Tampa 2? You spot drop to these spots, these corners, do their job. The safeties get to their landmarks. And man, there's lots of places to throw the ball. But all of a sudden, you get to the game, and if you have Dwight Freeney, or you have Warren Sapp and Simeon Rice, or you have Michael Bennett and Cliff Averill, and those four affect the quarterback, yeah, there's, you know where the guys are, but sheesh, here's a check down, and here's a check down, and here's a check down, and they make us go 10 or 12 plays, and all of a sudden, there's one holding call, there's one sack, and we're off the field. So in the heyday, and Earl and Richard, and I think Richard said this on one of his podcasts, like, yeah, man, we were pretty simple. We spot drop. We were pretty simple. But we knew every way that the offense wanted to attack us, right? If you're going to do that and you're going to drop to those zones, the offense goes, ooh, I like this over route, or I like these verticals, or I like this route, or I like this check down. And the defense gets so keen into how you're going to attack us. The thought is, oh man, we know how you're going to attack us just as well as you know your offense, mm-hmm. and we're going to be able to beat it. And we're going to create one negative play. We're going to get one sack where you're going to have one holding call. And all of a sudden, guess what? We're off the field because you have to check it down and it's 3rd and 13. We tackle, we swarm, we hit, we harass, we're violent, we're off the field. And now you're giving the ball back to us, which was a big part of their success for many, many years.
Are you saying then, and maybe I'm putting words in your mouth, but are you saying that the spot drop system works only if you have great players both up front and in the secondary?
Yes.
Whereas the more aggressive matchup system
can cover other spots
more for everybody?
Yeah, and it can
that
cover
you can
up.
Only run one if you have the right personnel for it, whereas this is a little bit more universal.
Yeah, and it's universal when 4 beat 5. Okay, that's universal. That's the SEC versus everybody else. When your front four D linemen that all get drafted to the NFL beat those 5, and you've heard me say that for 13 years and beat that drum to you, that's universal. Whatever you run, you're going to be better. But the Matt Schaubs of the world, the Davis Mills of the world, the average to below average quarterbacks, the elite ones, they can beat any defense. But the average to below average quarterbacks, when you are a simple spot drop team with an average front four, you can make them look good. And that's exactly what they have done for many years. And then when you play Josh Allen, he can go 30 for 31 in a first half against you and make you look so ridiculously
silly. Because
you
don't have the personnel to pull it off.
No, you don't. You don't. You don't have, and haven't had since Richard, a corner of his ilk with his size and playmaking ability, right? You have not had safeties. Now, Diggs is helped a little bit, and he's come in and been a difference maker. But, you know, the Cam Earl, after those guys departed, and you went through how many different average safeties, right, that can't cover ground, that aren't violent, that aren't Cam and Earl, mm-hmm. and aren't just unique human beings and unique creatures playing that position in a way that very few have, let alone, you know, your defensive line and a 6'5" linebacker in KJ in his prime that could run and cover and had arms forever and stretched out like a 2-3 zone from sideline to sideline. So that's what they had. Then that personnel left. Ken Norton tried to play that same defense with none of the personnel and got totally exposed. So enter Clint Hurt and enter Carl Scott and enter Sean Desai. And I think enter, quite honestly, the biggest difference for Seahawks fans going, gosh, game one on Monday Night Football, Russell Wilson. He doesn't have just wide open receiver after wide open receiver. They may still beat us. And, you know, we may get beat over the top, But these guys, it seems like the Seahawks defenders are a lot closer to these routes than they were the last 3 or 4 years. Hmm. Well, yeah, because they're playing the routes. Okay, so when you match, it's what the Rams do, right? And have done super successfully, and Brandon Staley, and what Vic Fangio has done through his tenure. All of a sudden, you look at all those personnel groups, all those formations, all those combinations, and go, okay, Bill Belichick, this is what they do out of these. They run this route combination. This is what they love to get to. So we're going to try to match by our play of our nickel and our corners and our safeties and our linebackers. Instead of just dropping to this green grass, we're going to drop and we're going to look up. You're going to hear that term. We're going to look up this route. We're going to look up this vertical, and we're going to look up this curl, and we're going to have people that are reading and matching and reacting to the route progression in a way that they haven't done in a long, long time.
Is this what your conversations are like with your dad, Howdy?
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly like it.
I just wanted to check to see if they were this in depth. I just want to make sure.
Do you remember?
Really get in the what it feels like.
It feels like being at home.
Wow, amazing. Okay, just
do you remember when Pete said to you and me, so either on the air, off the air, one of our Mondays, where he was just very intrigued by how Bill teaches what Bill is able to teach in New England, right? How he's able to morph each and every week, right? There was an intrigue for Pete Carroll. I think he has a respect for Bill Belichick more than any football coach on planet Earth, right? Because it, you know, is very, very different than his technique and his style and what he likes to do. And you can win with both, right? Both have won Super Bowl, and Pete's built two dynasties, a USC and with the Seahawks, doing it his way. But he was just so intrigued and curious how you can just morph week to week, kind of in principle, and how you match and how you route recognize. And that is why Pete went out and got Sean Desai and got Carl Scott and got guys that have some background in just in that understanding, in teaching those concepts. And man, it's going to be fun. I know that's crazy football talk, and I apologize. That's probably a little too much.
No, it's
great.
A
little excited there.
But it's important. And it because unfortunately, while I love it, and you've helped me with something, because my instinct is, after listening to a new coordinator come in and talk about their scheme, generally I yawn and go, uh-huh.
Yep.
Yeah, tell me about it. Guess what? All these schemes work. They all work. Right? Rex Ryan's scheme works. Pete Carroll's scheme works. The Tampa 2 works. Bill Bell. They all work. They all work if they have the right players. So, like, there's a big part of me that just sort of yawns and is like, all right, yeah, 3-4 instead of a 4-3. Okay, go find some different players. Great. I mean, you got to have the right players for it, but okay, cool. That doesn't make a defense go from bad to good. Oh, you're going to run Sean McVay's system instead of Don Coryell's. Like, okay. They all kind of work as long as you're committed to it and do it the right way and fit all the pieces together and have great players. So part of me sort of yawns at this whole thing, because I think that just having the right people and the right calls and all that is more important than the right system that you choose.
Mm-hmm.
But the piece that you said that probably rings more true than anything else to me is trying to play a system that you don't have the players for. And yes. That, I think, has a tremendous amount. Like, that yep. hits me.
Yep. It's what I said to the coach at West Point. God bless him.
Oh, yeah. He wanted you to come run Wishbone, right?
Yeah, brother.
Triple option?
The fall of 94. Phone call. You know, hey, you come here, Brock, to West Point. We will change our system. We will throw the ball. Yeah, coach, but we got one problem with that. 84 of the guys you recruited here and whom you can recruit to West Point. Guess what they do? They run the wishbone. So even if you wanted to change your system, it will take you years and years and years to bring in. And by the way, you'll never get those kind of guys to go to West Point to run that kind of system. They're going to go to Notre Dame and to the other schools, to Miami at that time and everywhere else in between. So I appreciate that. That really means a lot, but I'm not a wishbone quarterback, and I can't fit in it. But isn't that cool, honestly, as you said that
I kind of would have liked you not a wishbone quarterback, but as a West
Service
Point.
Academy?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I think you could have been a Service Academy guy.
No question.
Yeah.
No question. I think some of my 12-year-old son, certainly with the way he organizes his room and some of his mannerisms and the way he prepares, he's got some Service Academy stuff to him. But that is the beauty of football, man.
And me honestly, too, really. Honestly, I think we could both agree that I would have been fantastic in one of the Service Academies.
You'd have been so great asking why for everything and having new ways to do everything. The military typically loves new ways of doing things from people who don't have the resumes to put them out. That's really a military thing.
Your
penmanship's so good.
Yeah. No, I'd have been a good fit.
Yes.
I think in every way, I'd have been a really good fit. I mean, West Point for you, I really saw myself more in Annapolis, but okay.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I would have been a great fit.
Can I just say this, too, to kind of wrap up the nerdy little football stuff here, is you said that out loud, all of the different styles and systems. That's the beauty of football, man. That is so, so cool that you could have the wishbone. You could have the wing tee. You could have the veer. You could have the air raid. You could have Mouse Davis's, I'm blanking on Warren, the run and shoot. You could have all of these different systems, and then everything
the
defensively.
K-gun?
Oh, the K-gun.
The K-gun?
So, oh, the K-gun.
Jim
is so
Kelly?
Good. Yes. You can have triple option. You get,
Didn't
right,
Pete
you
tell
have,
us, by the way, that the K-gun is like a lot of what modern offense is now?
A lot of it, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep, a lot of check with me and a lot of 11 personnel and a lot of mixing formations with tempo, kind of checking and playing off of, oh, and then the RPO system that's so popular now, run pass options and everything off of it. You know, it is just football is so fascinating that way. Butch Goncharov can win how many championships out of you, Bellevue? 10, 12? Running the wing tee and getting your kids in third grade starting to learn the plays of the wing tee because you have like 15 plays in the wing tee, but we get so good at executing those within the scheme. And then when you add some dynamic dudes to it that transfer in and go to the Academy Institute.
The Academic Academy.
Right. How does how many championships Institute. Does Bellevue win with the wing tee if they don't get all those kids?
They still want them early. I mean, they still want them early. They probably don't win 10 in a row unless they start to add that kind of personnel to it because again, defenses can start to figure it out, but then you get the mix of like they had in 11 and 12 and 13 and 14 and 15 and why that Seahawks defense is one of the best to ever do it because mm-hmm. you mix scheme with personnel beautifully. They knew it inside and out. You had unique difference makers at, you know, so many, every level of that defense. You became one of the most dominant to ever do it. And I'm just glad now in this reset that there was a clear understanding that we don't have the personnel to do this anymore. And the personnel and where this game is going and speed and space and everything else, we better mix and match. We better draft our personnel to match this scheme with Clint and some new people. We better innovate and we better be different than we've been in years past.
Well, yeah. I'll tell you, the one thing you get out of Clint Hurd is that he is incredibly inspiring, right? I mean, he seems to have... he seems like a head coach, to be honest with you. He's got both the, what's the word I'm looking for? He inspires confidence that he really knows what he's talking about. And he's got just that energy level that gets you kind of fired up.
Yep.
Seems perfect for Pete. Honestly. Yep. Like, I can see why Pete hired him, and I can see why Pete promoted him. It makes perfect sense in kind of listening to him and talking to him.
One study I am going to do, and I was thinking about this today, after our conversation on your morning show and listening to Clint with you as well, is I do wonder, out of the 31 other defensive play callers, like the guys that call the defenses, how many of them come out of the D-line tree?
Mm.
Because... just as I mentioned to you earlier, O-line coaches, rules, regulations, stipulations, like this, it's, you know, systems have, you know, they see the world through their lenses, and why Andy Reid is much more the exception than the rule. He's one of the only O-line guys that is a head coach. I mean, there's just not many of them. Mario Cristobal down at the University of Miami is one, become kind of prominent on the college level, but most offensive coordinators are what? Former quarterbacks or QB coaches kind of come out of that tree. I am curious. I'm going to do a little digging on that. And maybe if a really adventurous podcaster or maybe Howdy's dad, maybe they've already had these conversations, he and Howdy's dad has done the study. But my gut says out of the 31 other play callers, most of them come out of the secondary room. Most of them have been flipped over, like Brandon Staley was a college quarterback, you're right, that flipped over to the defensive side and the secondary and the linebackers, right, and the play callers. A lot of them come out of the, like managers come out of being baseball catchers. I think a lot of D coordinators come out of being linebacker coaches because there's the signal callers, right? They're in the middle of the defense or on the back end of it. I am going to be kind of curious to do that
study. I would think
that
linebacker is probably the most common, would be my guess. Right, middle linebacker sort of has that job more than anybody
kind
else.
Kind of,
right?
But Pete, Bill Belichick, Nick Saban, all on the back end.
Jim Mora,
the
Howdy, come on. What? Why would you say that?
It's true.
Why, but still.
He came out of the secondary, became a head coach.
He sure is. And finally now coaching the Huskies, right?
That's right.
Lifelong dream.
But he was a walk-on linebacker, special teams kind of guy. And he's got that linebacker mindset.
Interesting.
It will be an inter. I'll do a little digging, and maybe a podcaster out there that's super adventuresome and wants to go look at the other 31 play callers, not just the coordinators, you know, because some of them are head coaches like Brandon Staley, but the ones actually calling the plays. Curious how many of them come out of that D-line tree. I'm going to bet you'll find most of them will be linebackers or certainly on the back end.
Do you think this defense is going to be better
than last year?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like significantly better?
I don't think they're going to have what they had the last 2 years, which is just like, right, 2 years ago, league worst, most awful halfway through. I mean, ever in the history of the league.
For the last 2 years, you've had incredible embarrassment.
Yeah.
It's been really, really embarrassing to be a Seahawks fan looking at that defense. Embarrassing.
Well, it's certainly not what Pete wants, right? I mean, you talk about Pete Carroll, and he's looking for a high-flying defense that is more athletic than everybody else, is a bully, takes the ball away, and they haven't done any of those things. This is why, to me, this is the most important conversation. It doesn't mean we'll talk about it more than we talk about Russell Wilson leaving, the offense, the quarterback, because obviously those things just affect you in so many ways, and they're more interesting in terms of conversation. But make no mistakes. The issue the Seahawks have had for the last half decade or so is not offensive. It's defensive.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a doubt in my mind about that.
Yep.
Like, I feel as convicted about that as any sports opinion I have, that their issues have been because of the defense more than they've been because of the offense. And so while I like everybody, wonder how that will play out offensively with, you know, the quarterback situation they have and with Russ gone and obviously what he does. And I think that, you know, we've talked about this. If Russ goes and throws for 6,000 yards and the Broncos go 14-3 and go to a Super Bowl, it's a really bad look for Pete Carroll.
Mm-hmm.
Really bad. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, you had this all along and you didn't decide to use it. Whoops. And if the other thing happens and Russ opens it up and, yeah, he throws for 5,500 yards, but he also throws 16 interceptions and it costs his team in big moments and they go 10-7 and are first round, you know, out in the playoffs, it's going to look really good for Pete Carroll. Like, yeah, that's kind of why we did what we did, and that's not necessarily the best way to win with this guy. So that's obviously the more sort of interesting soap opery conversation storyline that all narrative that all of us can follow. But the most important thing for the Seahawks is getting defense fixed.
Yep. Because along those lines in the initial build, and this is reboot, right? This is a retool. This is empowering John and Pete to do what they did the first time around. Remember that process. That process was what? Well, there's Matt Hasselbeck, and then there's T-Jack and Charlie Whitehurst, and then there's, okay, we found this young whippersnapper that's a difference maker.
Yeah, and they found Marshawn along the way, and they looked for wide receivers, and they got Mike Williams and Sidney Rice.
They built it.
Yeah.
Defensively.
Of course they did. And so, you know, who's the most important Seahawks draft pick? It's probably, you know, Mafe. Don't you think?
No.
It might be.
No.
No.
It might be. You think it's Charles Cross?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Gotta have that one.
Getting an offensive line that actually just does its job.
Well,
yes.
That might be true.
And to John and Pete's point, like there were nine difference makers in this draft, and you deemed him one of them. So he has to be at that kind of level.
That's fair. All right, fine. I'll buy that. Retracted, if you don't mind.
It's stricken from the record.
Howdy, cut that. Don't take that out. But fine. But you get my point.
I totally get your point. And it's why Jordan Brooks was a first rounder. And, you know, why they knew the end was near, not just with Russell, but with Bobby Wagner as well, that they were going to turn that page. And it's Daryl Taylor. We can, you know, come up in the second round and we draft him. And yeah, you take Boye Mafe there, number 40, a physical freak, and why you have invested capital and you re-sign Quandre Diggs. And obviously they went all in on Jamal Adams. And you're going to build this thing. You know, much like they did the first time around, they are going to build this thing defensively. And oh, by the way, we're going to completely blow up this defensive staff. Completely. We'll make one move on offense. We'll let Andy Dickerson come alongside Shane Waldron, and you know, we'll bring in a receiver coach that we're comfortable with. But we are going to blow up this thing schematically. We're going to bring people in here defensively that we don't have relationship with, and Desai and Scott, and they're going to marry with Clint Hurt, and we're going to take, as you said, his charisma and his confidence, and we're going to pair it with some of the horsepower on the back end of this thing with those two young whippersnapper coaches, and we're going to be young, and we're going to be violent, and we're going to be physical defensively, and we're going to build this thing on that side of the ball first and foremost, and let the quarterback and the offense come in the years to follow.
You mentioned Kyle's over at the Ghost Kitchen, Brock. I don't know if you find yourself getting ready for the summer here. It has not really felt at all like summer, although apparently it's going to turn into a little bit this weekend.
Did I see? I saw on a weather blog it's been the worst spring in Seattle history?
Yes. I think that's a definitive yes. I don't have any evidence about the previous ones, but it seems like the worst spring in Seattle history.
But it is going to be a real green summer out here, I'll tell you what.
Well, good. Finally. Fine. Hopefully there'll be some benefit. When you say a green summer, do you mean it's going to continue to rain all the way until September?
Sure, why not? Yeah, green out here all the time.
Well, if you're getting ready for those summer weddings or birthday parties, graduation gatherings, the whole deal, Famous Dave's Catering is ideal when you want your event to be delicious and memorable and stress-free. How nice does that sound? You pick the date, and they will handle the rest. Customized for delivery, pickup, full service, Famous Q is designed to allow you to kick back, relax, and crush some sawsome selections.
Ooh.
From the smoking starters and fresh salads to box meals and barbecue bundles, not to mention desserts, our slow cook goodness is ready to party when you are. Highlights, you ready? Ultimate barbecue bundle. I'm talking serving 10 people with two slabs of St. Louis style spare ribs.
Solid.
3 pounds of wings. That's a lot of wings. 3 pounds of wings.
Mm-hmm.
And the sauce of your choice, plus 2.5 pounds of barbecue pulled chicken or, howdy, Georgia chop pork.
Yes. I can't believe they just measure this by pounds. You know, you're eating good food, you're measured by pounds.
That's true.
Not ounces, it's pounds.
Pounds. 3 quarts of sides, 10 sandwich buns, the whole deal. You also got box meals with barbecue bowls, wraps, sandwiches, customizable sides, summer-inspired greens like the fresh garden salad. Howdy, we don't have to worry about that.
Nope.
Homemade desserts like Dave's award-winning melt-in-your-mouth bread pudding. We will definitely worry about that. You can get more info at famousdaves.com/catering. Brock, I'm surprised we've gone all this way. You've yet to ask me about my recovery. I know we talked a little bit about it, but after you know, all of the excitement last week leading into my big surgery or procedure, I guess you would call it, I figured you would be all over that today.
Well, yeah,
since you lied to me and tried to tell me that there would be some sort of wretched smell associated with my vasectomy, which there was not, thank God.
Well, there was for me. So maybe you had a cleaner operator. Maybe technology in the decade has gotten better.
Maybe.
I don't know. But there certainly was, you know, for
me. You did this a decade ago? Where? Like in the back of a U-Haul truck or something?
Please.
Yeah.
This is not a revolutionary procedure. They've been doing this for a while.
Oh. Brock's involved a smell that they certainly did not have last week.
Howdy, have you had a vasectomy yet?
I have had a vasectomy. It did not go well.
Yeah, Howdy had a problem.
Yeah, the recovery was a real, real long process. It was not great.
Gotcha. Well, I apologize for not asking you, but I told you last week, like, you were so open.
Yeah.
You shared that, and you had another story on last week's podcast, too. I was like, ooh, maybe next week it's time for me to be open.
Oh.
Maybe it's time for me to share. Well, Haley's boyfriend is staying with us this week.
Oh, was that a good conversation about vasectomies?
What do you mean? No.
Sorry.
No.
Right.
Don't go there.
Okay.
No, but this is a first. This is a first, like, big kind of, you know, just transitionary step. And
now, she's had boyfriends before. That's not new, right?
Nope.
And you've met them.
Yeah, absolutely.
But this is actually, what, staying at the house where
staying
it becomes the problem?
Yeah.
Problem.
Yes.
Well, or just where it's new, I should say.
Well, locked in the basement. But yeah, I mean, he's in the home.
He's actually locked him into a basement. Can't get out until Brock opens the door.
Are you actually like that? Are you truly like an intimidate and worry about your daughter's boyfriend guy?
No, you can't be that way.
You can't, right?
No.
Like, that's, first of all, it's cliche. But beyond that, like, doesn't that backfire?
You got to be who you are.
Right.
If you're, you know, there's some men that are a little more wired that way, right? That are just built a little more that way, that are just quiet, that don't talk a lot, that aren't transparent, that aren't open, that are pretty closed off and pretty grumpy and drink whiskey every night and whatever, right? There's still men of that ilk, but that's not me. So for me to try to be something I'm not would be just a joke. It would be
show up like in full camo with your buddy Hunter the Hunter or anything like that when he first arrived?
I did not. No, I did not.
Good.
I did not. Hi, Haley. How are you, sweetie? Oh, Haley just opened the door.
Wow. Oh, she heard the conversation.
She's been sitting outside your door.
I'm taping a podcast.
Wow.
We're just talking about you and Dylan right now. So, yep. Okay. Love you.
Yep. Wow.
There she is.
Nice hair, sweetie. It looks good.
Oh.
She got her hair cut today.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what dads are for.
Speak of the devil and they may appear.
Yeah. No, I would say in my years of this experience, and you're going to get to your Salk one day, right? Yes. These are kind of some of these neat little milestones and hurdles that I jump over before you do, just age-wise and parenting and such. Timing, and you'll get here. And I think you'll be pretty similar to me. You want to be who you are, pretty transparent with who I am, and not try to put on some facade or put on some show.
I don't see the value in that. Like, I just, all right, let's talk. Let's kind of get a chance to get to know each other. And,
that's right.
You know, I'll pass judgment my way. Like, if there's any judgment to be passed, obviously I'll do so. But I don't know. The whole intimidating, don't come to my house, this and that. Like, I don't know. That's not for me.
No, it doesn't really work.
Yeah. Locked in the basement, though, huh? That's a little bold.
One-way locks is how he said. I had those assembled.
One-way.
Week, so, yes.
it's like a dungeon, really. But, hey, whatever you want.
Yeah. I mean, we all saw Goonies, right? Like, you're just down there. Just junk. In the basement.
Or Baby Ruth.
What was his name?
It
was
his actual name?
Yeah, what was that character's name?
Well, Sloth. Yeah, he was an NFL player, right?
Yes.
I'll think of the guy's name. He was
an NFL Matuszak.
Player.
No.
It was. Yes. Was John yep. John Matuszak. Yes, I think that's exactly who it was. Yes.
Wow.
Speaking of locking people in the basement, what should we do about the Mariners? Like, who can we lock in a basement, Brock? I'm ready. I'm out for blood. A week ago, I was still sort of like, hey, you could do this, you could do that. You're not out of it yet. And they're not. But the last couple of games, the Mets series gives everybody a little bit of hope. You find a way to win those two games. Really could have won all three. And then you just go to Toronto, and the first two were just non-competitive again.
Yep.
Just, from an offensive standpoint anyway. Your pitching, you got to give these guys credit. Pitching's done its job. For the most part, every night, you're giving your team a chance to win the game. And it is, and I hate to say this, I said it out loud on the show the other day, and I felt a physical pang when I said it.
I think I know where you're going.
It's feeling. Doesn't mean it is, but it's feeling. A little reminiscent of 2010. Believe big, right? I mean, it's got some of those. Now, I'm not saying it's there yet. That season ended in such disaster, right? It's not just that Figgins and Kochman and all those things were a mess. They brought in Cliff Lee. They had a great rotation and couldn't hit. But that thing ended up with, you know, fights with Russell Branyon and Sean Figgins, and Walk got fired, and Junior left, and Sweeney. Like, all, remember what a mess it turned into? That team ended up being absolutely kind of detestable. But this team is not anywhere close to that.
It became as detestable as Kochman's pus in his eye.
Nothing was more detestable than Casey Kochman. Like, that guy was tough to watch.
Ugh.
But this team is not, they don't have any of those elements. Certainly not right now.
No.
But they do have the, like, big expectation, trying to build on last year, chemistry you were hoping would sort of continue to carry
through. Okay, let me cut through
this. You're not hitting, and you are pitching, and that feels similar.
Okay, let me cut through then and ask you this. Because in 2010, you and I were there. We were in that luncheon. When that sign was up and Jack Z was very uncomfortable.
Very.
Very uncomfortable. Like,
yes.
Oh, gosh, cart is way before the horses right now. Like, he knew, like, this is not good. This is not good. I don't think he knew that the personalities and the culture and everything would be so disastrous, and Sean Figgins would be one of the worst Seattle athletes ever.
Yes.
In treating people and playing and everything else. So he knew. He was nervous. Jerry and Scott, before the season began, I don't think they would have had, not that they put up banners that believe big, but they didn't minimize expectations. Did they?
No, they believed that it was time to go. It was go time.
Right.
And Jerry, here's the thing. Whether you need the words to tell you, okay, fine. Yeah, they did talk that way. You're right. But more importantly than that, they acted that way. Jerry went out and acquire Jesse Winker and Eugenio Suarez for Brandon Williamson and more. He gave up a significant piece of the future for pieces for the present.
Yep.
Right? He sacrificed years of control for on a potential star pitcher.
Established pros.
For an established bat.
Yes.
He said it was go time. And then he did it not just with his words, but with his actions. So,
and by the way, I'm assigning a Cy Young Award winner.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we're going to get a plug-and-play one-year veteran on a high-paid contract at second base in Adam Frazier instead of going on a multi-year kind of track or with a prospect or something like that. That's what they did.
So instead of minimizing expectations, really felt like we should build off of a 90-win season.
So should he have done more?
Yeah. Yes, definitively. And there was a good portion of people who were saying that right when the season started. This roster just does not look the same as the rest of the top 10 rosters in the American League. It's not built that way. It's built on a lot of hope. A lot of hope. You had to hope that Eugenio Suarez was going to bounce back. You had to hope that Julio Rodriguez is what he is right now. That's great. You had to hope that Jared Kelnick built on last year and Abraham Toro and that Adam Frazier's first half was his real self and not his second half and that Luis Torrens was going to move forward and that Cal Raleigh was going to move. You had a lot of hope. These guys need to move forward in order for this to work out instead of relying on track record and guys that have just recently proved it.
So okay, a couple of interesting points about that. Okay. One, isn't every team kind of built on hope a little bit?
Yes, but there's the caveat.
Every team has some of those things you just said.
There is a caveat there. Teams that are built on hope but are competing usually have absolute entrenched studs, 3 to 5 of them on their team.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not how the Mariners are built right now because they're still building.
Right.
And they did not have that base when they started this season.
Well, is that the argument then for not going farther in? That you weren't actually fully ready to get to that point because you didn't have those established studs that you're talking about?
The argument in favor of going bigger in this preseason was that there was cornerstone established pieces available, and you chose not to pay the price for them.
And all of them have been bad.
In prospects or in... And it's May for those guys in 1 year.
That's fine, but it's May for the Mariners too. But they've all been bad.
In prospects or in money. Your big addition was right now a platoon hitting outfielder who's now a DH. And they passed on all sorts of other major hitters that have track records that are still in their prime and decided to go that route instead. Like, there's a lot out there.
It's funny that those aren't the ones that are kind of driving me crazy, to be honest with you. Like, I'm not upset that they didn't bring in Trevor Story, Chris Bryant, or any of those things. Yes, I would have liked some of that, but I'll tell you what, if they had gotten Marcus Semien and he'd shown up and was doing what he's doing right now, and you had him for the next like 8 years or whatever the heck that deal is, I think people would be even more mad than they are right now. I mean, can you imagine? Semien's been atrocious. Bryant is hurt and was bad before he got hurt. Story is getting booed off the field at Fenway Park. I mean, you can make a pretty good case that none of the guys that they considered, and even some of the guys you talked about trading for, guys like Whit Merrifield's been awful, Brian Reynolds in Pittsburgh has been mediocre to poor. I mean, like, no one of those guys is really doing what you would expect them to do. So, and I don't believe in watching them that Eugenio Suarez is the problem. I'd like to see more out of Winker, but when I see it, I think Jerry was in a bind, and this is why I'm not 100% convinced that it's as simple as we kind of want it to be, because he's stuck a little bit in between. He wants to compete, and it's just about time to do so, and he's got some players that are ready to go, but at the same time, he's also trying to find playing time and development for a couple of kids that are a big part of your long-term future, but might not be ready to carry a team just yet.
Mm-hmm. You pointed to 2010. Can I tell you what's been resonating in my noggin? And you pointed out, like, this is just from a feeling standpoint. You know what's resonating in my noggin? That guy that you had on before the year, the human computer.
Dan Szymborski.
From Zips or something?
Well, he created Zips.
He created Zips.
Yes.
And
the Z in Zips is for Szymborski.
His numbers were kind of scary. His numbers, right? The Zips numbers and the projections and everything else for this lineup and for this roster.
Yeah.
It was not a 98-win team. It was not the New York Yankees. It was not what the Angels and Astros are up to. It's not.
No, although he said at the time, like, look, I might be a little low on this for reasons A, B, and C, because all they do is kind of look at last year, right?
Yes, but reasons A, B, and C of looking at last year and to Howdy's point of projecting for hoping these things come together, that's not the human robot's world.
Yeah.
They don't, the hope doesn't live inside those algorithms. What lives inside those algorithms and inside those numbers is past production trying to project what's to come. And those numbers were a little leery before the season began. Mm-hmm. I don't think they were 16-21 and 8 games back in mid-May, which is where you find yourself, and injury is a part of that, and a couple teams have been hot, schedules a part of that. But, you know, the numbers are pretty clear right now of what kind of ball club you are.
No, I think that's not good enough. But I guess the issues I have are more with some of the guys that you did choose to believe in and give some significant opportunities to rather than the guys that they could have had. Right. Like, to me, I'm more aggravated in the number of at bats going to Abraham Toro and unfortunately the decline this year, which I did not see coming. Maybe I should have. And Luis Torrens has just done absolutely nothing after being one of your better hitters at times last year, especially in the second half of the year. I mean, the thing about the Mariners and the whole like fun differential versus run differential is that as bad as all of that looked at times last year, they also had a positive, very positive run differential after that San Diego series.
Mm-hmm.
Like at a certain point, as their team came together, they stopped being a negative run differential team that was still sort of carrying the tail of earlier in the season. So I don't know. I kind of looked at it and thought that there really was the opportunity for them to move forward. And there still is, right? I mean, it's not like this thing is over yet. But if you're Jerry DePoto, you're kind of caught in a spot right now where what do you do? You double down on what you've got and go trade for Will Myers or somebody who's like another big bat to help you right now? Is it worth throwing more assets at the problem? Do you look for sort of a lower level type of a thing just to get you through until Mitch Haniger comes back? Do you find the name I threw out Howdy earlier was Kevin Pillar? He's got some off-field issues that aren't like perfect, but you know, AAA right now with the Dodgers, had an 800 OPS 2 years ago. I mean, like 33, I think he is, 32, 33, like still able to contribute and give you a professional at bat in right field for a couple of months. Do you just look to sort of survive? What do you do right now?
Well, you can't go hard because there's too many holes to plug. There's way too many. You need to replace your whole bench and two starting position spots. That's not realistic. So you just kind of have to sit there and hope. Just hope it gets better. Because there's not enough you can do to fix this lineup.
Well, and by the way, it's also hard when right now in Tacoma is Kyle Lewis, is Jared Kelnick, and is Evan White.
Mm-hmm.
And in the building process, right, we spent the whole last segment talking about the building process, the rebuilding process, the retooling process of what's going on. In the kind of process of where this thing was supposed to be sitting in 2022 and moving it forward, the fact that those three right now, for all differing reasons, right? I mean, two of them for injury, obviously, with Kyle and Evan, but, you know, that's the odds.
Yeah, but you have to know that, Brock. I mean, that's part of the deal of becoming a... of growing into being a contender, is you know that not all of your guys are going to work out.
Yep.
Right? I mean, that's part of it. And Jerry knows that. If you were to talk to Jerry, that's not a surprise.
And it's why they've tried to backfill and why they've had more waves and why so many of us were so excited this season and coming into this season is this is different. This is not just one and counting on one. And I'm going to be going fishing in Alaska in a couple weeks. You're not just counting on one pot of fish, right? One little slew that comes in. You know, okay, we missed that little wave of fish, but we know the next group of kings are coming in and the next group of kings are coming in. And this was, you know, this was built with some supply chain positive that you have waves of prospects at every single level.
And they do. That hasn't gone away. But the challenge comes in what do you do in the meantime while you're sort of testing those guys out? How do you give them the opportunities that they need to succeed and grow in Major League Baseball while also building a team that can compete and doesn't count on those guys?
Yep.
I don't know the answer to that, and I'm not entirely sure what some of the other teams have done other than that they maybe didn't do so many at one time.
That's it. That's it. There's so many guys that they're counting on at once.
Yeah, and I think the problem is it's not even so much the young guys that hadn't done it at all that they were counting on.
Right.
It's the guys who'd only
done it for...
It's
the Winker's a 950 OPS guy. Just be who you've been the last couple of years.
I mean, that one's brutal. That's a killer. There's no reason that guy shouldn't be good. But I think it's more the, like, I think what's gotten them, yes, that's some bad luck there. It's the counting on the guys who've done it a little, right? It's
Tom Murphy, Louis Terrence.
Right, those. Mm-hmm. Like, well, they've
Mal
done
Raleigh,
it a little.
Dylan Moore.
Right? Like, oh, they've done it a little. I've seen it. And you have. You saw it for two-thirds of a season. Terrence last year was really good.
Mm-hmm. But,
that's not enough to judge.
But asking a little to become a lot.
Yeah.
In the professional baseball world today, where it is so hard to hit. And by the way, I was looking at the Mariners' numbers before, like, oh my gosh, this has been so hard to watch. We talked about the runs and shutout again and non-competitive in these games. They're still like 19th in baseball in average. They're 17th in baseball in OPS.
Right.
They're not even at the bottom of it.
Like, oh, no. The whole league has been way hard in terms of those things. Yeah.
It's
and the
hard.
Pitching's
brutal
ridiculous
league.
And all.
Yes.
And by the way, their pitching's been really good. So as we sit here and torch some of the problems they've had offensively, the rotation's been phenomenal. I mean, Robbie Ray hasn't been quite what we expected. But at the end of the day, Logan Gilbert's been great. Marco's been Marco. Flexen's been Flexen, hasn't gotten any support. I mean, like, you know, there's reason to believe that this is a pretty good rotation that could, if not carry you, absolutely give you a chance to win most games.
Yeah. Yep.
But you got to score runs.
Yes.
This is Brock and Sox Blue 88.
Blue 88! Blue 88!
We take you to the field as Brock Huard breaks down three football questions as only he can.
Now here's your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Song.
All right, Brock, we'll finish off with a little Blue 88 heading into to finish this thing up today. And we'll start with Russell Wilson, question number one, because we didn't really get a chance to talk about it here in the podcast last week. But yes, Russell will be returning in week one on Monday Night Football to close out the weekend to Seattle. What do you think? How does it, forgetting about the off-field reaction and how the fans react and all of that, what does that look like on the field? What does Pete Carroll have in store for Russell Wilson and vice versa?
I think huge advantage for the Seahawks. Huge advantage to play week one. In that building where it will be full throat, where the tickets are impossible to get. Very, very, very tough. I'm talking to some of my friends who wanted tickets and everything else and tried to get them some help. And sorry, I mean, it is off the charts as far as the demand for that. But I think it is huge, huge, huge advantage for the Seahawks, not only because they know Russell inside and out, but you have Russell and Nathaniel Hackett the first time doing the rodeo together, riding together. First time head coach in that environment. Russell coming back into that environment. They've got to learn each other. I don't care who you are. I was listening to some Denver folks talk about the first five games for Peyton Manning. When Peyton Manning came to Denver, you know what their record was through five games? 2-3. And that was with John Fox, an established head coach. So Nathaniel Hackett's going to be learning on the job. Russell knows the game. He's healthier than Peyton Manning was when he came back from his neck injury. So there was that little caveat to it. But I think it is a huge, huge advantage. The Seahawks have a new defense, have a new defensive staff. Everything we talked about in the opening segment, right? What Russell knew of the Seahawks, both from a personnel, but even more so from a scheme. Very, very different from what he is going to see. Huge unknowns in that way, I think, are advantage to the Seahawks. The Seahawks don't really know who they are or aren't, and have not struggled, have not had some losses, have not had some tough bumps in the road. We'll also have, if it is Drew Locke, you know, some unknown of what that's going to look like with him under center. So I think all the way around, the league did the Seahawks an enormous favor scheduling that one game one in Seattle with all of those unknowns.
Yeah, and obviously week one, weird things happen, right? I mean, forgetting about just the Russ situation, right? Just in general, weird things happen in week one, right?
Yes, and Russell could come out and throw for 450 yards.
He could.
He could. He could. And have a slew of weapons. And
it's true.
And
it could We've be seen him do that in week one, too.
Yes, we could.
Right? Kind of before things go
Lord
awry.
Lord have mercy, we got Percy. Yeah,
yeah.
Crazy things happen.
Yeah, that's for sure. Okay, well, yeah, now you have me feeling good and bad, kind of all at once. That'll be a heck of a Monday or Tuesday morning coming in after all that goes down.
What do you think the reaction? Did you take a little bit of a pulse of the
We
people?
Did a little bit. It's hard, as you know, because it's not like baseball where he gets announced, right? Like, we've kind of gone through this before. There's no moment where they're like, now batting, number three.
True.
Like, that doesn't really happen. So the moment where everybody collectively decides to cheer, boo, whatever, it doesn't really happen in an NFL game. I forget where we learned this. Oh, God, who was it who came back and, like...
Griffey. And we thought it'd be, like, a 40-second, like, crazy...
No, it wasn't Griffey. It was
Are you sure?
Football. No, it was a football player who came back, and, like, we weren't really able to determine kind of what the reaction was to him because... there's no real opportunity.
Sherman, probably Richard.
Maybe it was Sherm. Yeah, maybe it was. That's probably the most likely.
Yep.
Basically, it was pretty split evenly. A lot of people are going to cheer, a lot of people are going to boo, and a lot of people are going to passive-aggressively do nothing.
Yep. And then there's Salk.
I'll be Boeing. Question number two. I know you've been talking a lot about name, image, and likeness stuff, the NIL, and while I like it, Brock, I think I'm fairly willing to grant the fact that the combination of NIL with free ability to transfer is not really what sports is supposed to be. It's essentially creating free agency, full-time free agency every year for every player.
Yeah.
And I don't know that you can run a sports league that way. So what's going to happen next?
I mean, the challenge is who is going to be the arbiter of change? And can it quite possibly, realistically, be the NCAA?
Who else could it be?
Congress, the league commissioners, right? I mean, it could be Greg Sankey and the power commissioners from all the power conferences saying, you know what, this is just, we've got to do something. Like, this just isn't right. Mm-hmm. We can't wait on Congress. NCAA has been neutered. It will have some new leadership as Mark Emmert leaves and departs, but they have basically washed their hands and said, yeah, our risk tolerance team and what the Supreme Court decided to do, 8-0, in their vote and everything else, like, we wash our hands and we will not be sued. And every decision that we are going to make is how do we protect ourselves from not being liable. And, well, therefore, we deregulate and you guys figure it out and you guys make the rules. And what we're seeing is total and utter chaos. It's not sustainable. To your point, it's not even about kids making money. It is about just free agency. It's about luring kids to your school. It is about recruiting them. It is about your boosters recruiting them. It's about procuring your talent through those monies, through just unrestricted free agency at all times of a calendar year, every single season. It's not sustainable. So I think the key is, who is going to be the agent of change? Who is truly going to be the agent of change? I saw, I think, of all people, Maria Cantwell last week tweeting and applauding, Greg Sankey and George Kliavkoff going back to Congress. And I just have a hard time believing the state of affairs where our country is, that group is going to be the one to unify and bring everybody together. I believe it's going to be those five, Power Five commissioners. Bob Boolsby's retiring, so maybe it's just four. And maybe more than anything, it's Greg Sankey, the loudest, most powerful voice, commissioner of the SEC, that decides and says, okay, for the best interest of the whole, we're going to look to build in, and we will, in this conference, actually be the ones to spearhead some of that change.
That'll be an interesting one, man. They're going to have to do something. I like the idea that kids are getting paid, and they deserve it, and I think that stuff's great. But I don't know what you're going to do about the fact that you've essentially...
Man, I know, I know it was a totally different era. In fact, it was a different century that I played in. And then even into the NFL. But I just remember even in those days, like when we would get a new junior college guy, right? It was such a just a different dynamic. It was one thing to get new recruits, right? But you understood, like, every year, in fact, you hosted guys. In fact, I hosted Taylor Barton and Marcus Tuiasosopo and those guys on their recruiting trips. And you tried to recruit guys, and there were certain guys you really liked and you wanted to see come and be a part of your program. And so you kind of knew that was the way of transaction, that was how you add it to your team. And maybe occasionally you got a junior college transfer. And when you did, it was like, oh, who is this guy? Who is Supeli Malepele? Where is he from? Where has he been? What's he been doing? What's at junior college? And it was just a different dynamic. To try to imagine the wholesale amount of turnover and change, right, for both the team and then the player, right? The Huskies just got a kid from UAB. I've been commuting to Birmingham. I know in that stadium, and he's a good player, Conference USA, All League, whatever. There's no connection to the Pacific Northwest. He has no background with anybody. He's just a hired gun. He's just a commodity to come in for 4 or 5 months, even after spring ball here. And it'd be so weird to team build and welcome him in, and how is this all going to work, and how are we all going to get on the same page, and how are we going to grow, and how are you going to understand our culture, and how are we going to develop and do all of that when there is just this constant turnstile of change? Yeah, it's hard culture build.
All right, question number three. All right, this one's not really a football question, but Brock, is Jordan Spieth going to win this weekend? Let's be clear. Let's talk about the most important thing. Kyle, are you still here? Can we talk about the most important situation? Kyle stepped out now? Oh, son of a gun. That's too bad. Brock, he's playing the best golf of his life. Well, maybe not of his quite. Life. Not of his life. But the
retract
best golf
that, in Howdy. Year. Second retract retraction of the podcast. Yep.
He's playing his best golf in 3 years.
Yep.
He is the whatever was going on with a sort of weird swing routine ahead of time. Uh-huh. That seems to be gone, and now it's just yep. sort of a one rehearsal, and then he's off and running.
Rory
short
is
game's great.
It. Rory
he's,
is
he's driving
it.
The ball better than he ever has in his career this yep. year. What is the difference between Dustin Johnson's average drive and Jordan Spieth's?
Ooh, do
how
not
many
know.
Yards?
Do not know.
2 yards.
Well, that's Dustin using his 3-wood, but yeah.
No. With drive, stop
no,
it.
No, I get it. I
with
get it.
Driver, stop it. How dare
Dustin's
you?
Dustin's hybrid. Uh-huh.
You're the worst. He's been first and second in his last two starts. Yep. This course sets up for him perfectly. Will Jordan Spieth win this weekend?
No, he won't.
Oh, God.
I mean, I hope so. I golf is better when he's in it. Golf is better when I can instigate, and it's going to be perfect because I'm going to get to antagonize all next week. He's going to be great for 3 of the 4 rounds. You know?
Oh, but there's one gets yep, away.
There's just going to be one that just kind of gets
it
away.
It does happen.
Friday or Saturday.
It does seem to happen.
Sunday, who knows? That's yeah. that's the next hurdle in okay. a major yeah. for him to jump
well,
over.
It's not the next hurdle. I mean, he's done that before.
He has.
He's won 3 majors.
He has.
Yeah.
Has he done it since 12 at Augusta?
Yes.
He has.
Yes.
He won a British?
He won the Open Championship the next year.
Not the British. Gosh.
Yes.
It's the Open Championship.
Yes. So that whole idea of the 12 at Augusta, that he's gotten over that, clearly. He won a major after that.
Okay.
So you cannot just throw that out there.
Okay. Retract that.
All right. Thank
Howdy.
You. Good. Do some retract.
Wow.
What do you make of
Rory Tiger
Jordan,
and Jordan
Tiger.
Thursday?
How incredible is that?
Gosh, just awesome.
Better
awesome.
Than the top three in the world playing together?
Which are?
John Rahm, Scottie Scheffler, and Colin Morikawa. That's
yeah.
another pairing.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Much, doesn't have quite the same star power.
No.
Not quite the same.
Much, much better.
Do you catch any of Tiger talking about Phil? Did you catch any of that?
No.
Oh, Tiger was like, they were like, oh, did you reach out to him? He's like, no. Just like, no chance. Absolutely not. He dug his own grave. We disagree. I'm all good here. Thanks.
Pretty crazy, right? Like 1 year ago, where was it? Down in Kiwa Island. Oh, my gosh.
Yep. Things have changed pretty significantly.
Things have changed really quickly.
All right. Things change for us as well. We'll be back in another week, and we'll talk to you all then. Until then, the hey.
Is in tomorrow, Martin.
See you, everybody.
Get to the chopper!